Do you ever ache for a piece of your past? Maybe a younger version of yourself that feels long gone? Novelist and essayist Andre Aciman knows all about longing, even if the past he remembers never really existed, except in his imagination.
I was born in Alexandria, Egypt, but I am not Egyptian. I was born into a Turkish family, but I am not Turkish. I was sent to British schools in Egypt, but I am not British. My family became Italian citizens, and I learned to speak Italian, but my mother tongue is French. For years as a child, I was under the misguided notion that I was a French boy who, like everyone else I knew in Egypt, would soon be moving back to France. Back to France was already a paradox, since virtually no one in my immediate family was French or had ever set foot in France. But France and Paris was my sole home, my imaginary home, and will remain so all my life, even if, after 3 days in France, I cannot wait to get out. Not a single ounce of me is French.
Andre Aciman now lives in New York City, but he still considers himself an exile without a country that's really his own. In his new collection of essays called Alibis, Aciman reflects on his memories of various places he's loved. He recently stopped by our studio to talk with Steve Paulson.
One theme that comes up over and over in your essays is memory, but it's a very complicated notion of memory, not just remembering what happened, but it might be the memory of a longing or a disappointment, or as you put it, of imagined happiness. Why is memory so central to your writing?
I think there are many answers one could give to that. One of them is because when you've lost something that you believe is important, you always revisit that loss. You tend to look back more than you look forward, because you're always trying to recreate the narrative that brought you here. You're trying to understand, you know, what is this trajectory? What is the itinerary that brought you to where you are today? Not to have that is to feel completely lost.
Is there always an element of longing then in
yes.
these memories?
Yes. Again, it's a complicated question. You long for something that was in the past, that was very important, and then you spend your whole life trying to recover it. Most people have that when it comes to their childhood. Even if it was a bad childhood, they long to recover those footsteps. In my case, I long to recover something that I never loved. So that puts me in a totally paradoxical position. In my case, the big mysterious place is Alexandria.
Alexandria, Egypt.
Right. That's where I come from. That's where I was born. And that's where I was kicked out of as a Jew who had to leave Egypt. But I never liked Alexandria. Whom am I kidding? I've never kidded myself. I wanted to get out of Alexandria. But nevertheless, this is the place that I go back to when I try to understand what happened to me, who I am. Where am I going? How can you know where you're going if you don't know where you've come from?
So this is not nostalgia, then. This is something different.
Oh, yes, it is. And many people confuse it with nostalgia because that's the easy name for it. It is not, because you cannot be nostalgic for something that you couldn't wait to get out of. There's also another component. It's the idea that most of our memories are made up of things we wished we had and never got. And so those become memories too, by the way.
So in other words, a memory is not always an accurate recreation of what actually happened. It might be quite fictional.
Totally. In other words, if you are in a place, let's say you were in jail and you don't like the jail, and every day in jail you kept thinking of places outside the jail that you've never even visited, but you imagined them. Well, guess what? You will have memories of those places that you never visited. And wishes. So wishes have a long history, and most people cannot tell a wish from an actual event in the past because they got conflated.
Well, this raises all kinds of interesting questions for a memoir writer, because ostensibly you are telling the truth. You are rendering on the page what actually happened. But of course, we know that anyone who's looking back decades to try to recall those details embroiders, perhaps, lies. I don't know.
You could do that. The way I call it, to put a nicer spin on it, is to say that I switch the furniture around. The furniture is all there, but you need to create a narrative. And sometimes very faithful narratives are extremely boring. You need to skip details, or you need to make adjustments so that detail A and detail G follow each other right away as if it were A and B. So you skip steps, but the furniture is all there. So my life in Egypt happened exactly as I tell it. And my family, including those people that lived 50 years before I was born and whose dialogues I couldn't have heard because I wasn't even in my mom's tummy. Okay, nevertheless, I think that I captured their voices and their feelings as accurately as gossip reported it to me. And gossip is, for me, a font of information superior to history.
Do you have any qualms about recreating conversations and actually putting those conversations within quotes? I mean, things that happened decades ago?
Not a single one. And I will tell you ultimately why. Because the people who were there and who said those things said, you captured X and Y's voice perfectly. You captured their personality. This is exactly what I said. No, you couldn't have said that because I invented it. But I got you well enough so that you yourself are persuaded I was writing about you. And that for a writer is the ultimate sort of accolade.
Well, it raises fascinating questions about what truth is. You're suggesting that there can be greater truth in a certain degree of fiction.
Well, that goes back to Aristotle, who said, you know, history tells it as it is, you know, literature as it could, might, should have been. And I find that the could, might, should far more accurate when it comes to people.
Now, if there's one writer who seems to hover over your own writing, it would be Proust, I would think. Sort of this whole question of memory and, you know, how you create a narrative arc out of memory. How formative an influence was he?
Well, Proust is someone I knew when I was a kid. I was 14 years old. My father spoke to me about Proust. It was my father who introduced me to Proust. And he said, you will like Proust. And of course, right away, as soon as he said that, the first impulse was, I'm going to hate Proust. Okay, I'm not sure I like you. So how can I like Proust? But he told me a couple of things about Proust, about memory, smell, and long sentences. And guess what? All three I knew I was fascinated by before reading Proust. So I deferred reading Proust as far as I could, or at least reading the whole book. But once I got into it, it is the most eye-opening experience that I've had intellectually in my whole life, because you are finding on paper somebody who is you. And I think that's the ultimate trick of literature, is to tell you a story that you never had, but is your story. I've never experienced intimacy with a writer at that level. And yes, the whole idea of smell, which I've always been particularly affected by since I was a child, I recovered in him. So, oh God, he's done that too now. What else is left? Oh, and he's got the bungling, stupid narrator. I've got that too. So,
why smell? Why is that such a primal sense?
I don't know. Somebody explained it to me by saying that it ties right into the directly to the limbic system. So what does that say about me? I have no idea. But I know that when I was a child, and I'm saying this about very, very young, I'm 2 or 3 years old, I lost my grandfather and I remember him, even though I was 2 when he died, and you're not supposed to. But I remember the smell of the house after he died. And the smell was so powerful because I thought he was still there but didn't want to be seen. That sense of smell, I recovered that odor time and time again. And it must have taught me that in smell, you recover something very powerful that is lost. And since I've lost many, many things since I left Egypt, the sense of smell is basically the permanent address. That's where you go to recover who you are. You know, I was just writing about this the other day. The smell of a pencil shaving in an afternoon in September brings back to me horrible school days of when I was a grade school kid. I hate that smell of pencil shavings. Okay, I want to run away from it, but I'll test it again and again to say, is it really that horrible? Yes, it is. But of course, part of me says, you know, in that smell, there is a part of me.
You mentioned another way that Proust influenced you was long sentences.
Yes.
Why are you attracted to using long sentences?
Oh, because I hate endings. Basically, Proust's sentences are long because he's exploring. He's not trying to state something. He's just opening up widening the net as far as he can in order to capture something that is fundamentally uncatchable, intractable. But it's also a way of becoming extremely effusive with your thoughts, not just your feelings, and trying to allow the thought to dilate so much so that it has the space it needs to speak itself. Whereas short clipped sentences, which we're all encouraged to do, especially if we want to be published, and Strunk and White will certainly sort of support that, a short clipped sentence is an information bringer. It tells you, you know, how was the postman dressed when the dog bit him, period. It's not interested in the more intangible aspects of life. And I am interested in the intangible aspects of it. So a long sentence creates a particular mood, a particular cadence. Rhythms are in place so that you can actually trap those things that might otherwise escape the short sentence writer.
Andre Aciman talking with Steve Paulson. His book is called Alibis, Essays on Elsewhere.